From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Baseball season is in full swing, and the Boston Red Sox, now free of their curse, are defending world champions. And today, we look back on the golden age of baseball and one of its greatest stars. My guest is Ben Bradley Jr., and his new book is The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams. Ben Bradley Jr., welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks a lot. Good to be with you.
This book is about the most definitive work, I mean, ever on a ballplayer. It's the length that's usually reserved for political figures. Why such a book for Ted Williams?
Well, he was a national icon, really, and I grew up in Boston. I'm old enough that I saw him play when he was at the end of his career, late 50s, and I would go to Fenway Park every chance I could get. And he was really something to see, and I think the greatest hitter who ever lived, the last guy to hit 400. And when he died in 2002, I was struck in his death how much interest there still was in his life, and how many lives he had touched. I remember the Boston Globe ran a page of letters, and they were from grandfathers talking about how they had introduced their sons to baseball through Ted Williams, and their sons to their sons. So he was a certain glue in the social fabric. And I remember reading doing a quick read of the early books on Williams, and they were all done by sports writers who concentrated on his exploits on the field, but there was very little about his life off the field and what made him tick. And I thought that I could make a real contribution there. I didn't skimp on the baseball, but I decided to concentrate on the much less chronicled parts of his life, like his childhood growing up in the Depression in San Diego, his troubled relationship with his mother, how he was Mexican-American, which hardly anyone knew, and concealed that because he was worried about prejudice of the day, how he fought in two wars, which is just unfathomable to imagine today that a professional athlete would do that. He really led quite a tumultuous, interesting life.
So during his lifetime, you hadn't conceived of writing about him. It was after his death?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I had he was sort of a childhood hero of mine, but I never really imagined that I would one day write a book about him. It was just studying the reaction to his death, and you know, of course, there was a controversial ending. Perhaps we'll talk about that later. Cryonics.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so you really, how long did it take you? Because this is a long book. I don't want to dissuade anybody from reading it, because it's a great book, but it's a very, you know, it's a commitment to read. But
yeah.
It must have been quite a commitment to write.
Well, it took me, in hindsight, I guess, an embarrassingly long time, 10 years or more. Uh-huh. But, you know, that were 600-odd interviews and 800 pages, and that takes time. And I think and there were days when the muses weren't firing on all cylinders, but I persevered. And, you know, I got a lot of new stuff in the book. I mean, the turning point for me was getting his two daughters, who had never spoken before about their father, to give me in-depth interviews, and that opened up a lot of doors and you know, significant new information in the book.
Oh, there's a lot new. I mean, I thought I knew everything I needed to know about Ted Williams when I read Richard Ben Kramer's article, and then it turned out there was a lot more, though. Talk a little bit about, let's just start with, how frustrating was it for him to play during those years of the curse in Boston?
Well, Yeah, I mean, one really doesn't associate the curse with Williams. The curse seemed to grow more profound later, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. In Williams' day, you know, they only got close once, and that was 1946 when they won the pennant and then lost the World Series to the St. Louis Cardinals in seven games. But in the 50s, his second full decade, the Red Sox teams were lousy. And, of course, one of the reasons they were lousy was they were the last major league team to integrate, infamously. It wasn't until 1959 that the Red Sox became the last team in Major League Baseball to have a black player.
So a full dozen years after Jackie Robinson.
Pumpsy Green, yeah. And so they were never really close in to being a winning team in the Williams years. So one doesn't really associate the curse so much with the Williams years, because mostly they were never in contention. they were in contention from 46 to 1950, and that was about it.
Well, but of course, your revelation that he was Hispanic, I mean, wouldn't that in fact mean that they had integrated before they even knew it?
I guess so. except he never announced it and concealed it. You know, he was worried that prejudice of the day was going to hurt his baseball career. So he chose to conceal this his entire life. And that was one of the things that interested me the most. And one of the first things I did when I started my reporting out in San Diego was try to track down his Mexican relatives. His mother was Mexican. She had been born there and had family going back several generations, as far back as I could trace. And the Mexican part of her, you know, her brothers and sisters and cousins, and most of them had settled up in the Santa Barbara area. And I found a very friendly first cousin of Ted's, and she said, come on up, I'll convene a little family reunion for you. And I went up there, and, you know, one of the first things that struck me when I went into this room of about 25 people was how dark they were.
Hmm.
And, I mean, really dark. And Williams, you know, was
pretty
very
skin.
White.
Yeah.
And he had his father's genes. Father was very Anglo, carried the last name Williams. So no one ever suspected that Ted was Mexican-American. And these people were very proud of their famous baseball-playing cousin. But at the same time, there was quite a lot of resentment there, too, because he had shunned them growing up. And they told me this very revealing story of what happened in 1939 when, at the end of Ted's rookie year with the Red Sox, he'd made this huge splash in the American League. And he returned home to San Diego, the conquering hero. And about 100 of the Mexican side of the family turned out to greet him at the train station. Ted stepped off the train, took one look at this at the family, and hightailed it in the other direction. Didn't want to be seen with them.
Hmm.
And that still sticks in their craw to this day.
Was Ted Williams, could he speak Spanish?
No. Never spoke Spanish. But at the very end of his life, I think got more interested in it and in his heritage and was willing to speak about it, you know, privately, never publicly. One guy he spoke to about it was Nomar Garcia Parra, the Red Sox shortstop of the
their World Series team.
The '90s, yeah. And because he grew up in Los Angeles, Mexican American, and Ted kind of adopted Nomar as his one of his favorite modern day players, and you know, served as his kind of informal hitting coach, and they got to be buddies. I interviewed Nomar for the book, and he told me about how they got to talking about their Mexican American heritage together.
We're talking with Ben Bradley Jr., and his new book is called The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams. You call it The Immortal Life of Ted Williams, and I guess there's that. I know you mean that seriously, but I guess also there's a question about his immortality you alluded to earlier. I guess one of the most famous things now when people think of Ted Williams is his head.
Well, it's intended, the word immortal, as a double entendre, because I guess we're going to talk about cryonics, right?
Yeah, if you don't mind.
You know, cryonics, for those of your listeners who don't know, and that's, I think, most people,
yep.
It's not a science. It's a hope or a belief that one day, a hope or a belief held by a few thousand hardcore believers, that one day medicine will advance to the point where it'll be possible to cure you of whatever it is you've died from and somehow bring you back to life. And a lot of holes in the theory, to say the least. You know, they haven't worked out if Ted would come back as a 83-year-old man that he died of, or a young stud who could hit 400 again.
If it was just his brain that allowed him to do that. Or, I mean, they preserved his body as well, right?
Well, they preserved his body, but cut off his head. And people say, well, why do you do that? The cryonicists believe that that the brain is the most important thing to preserve. They assume that you know, medical science is advancing so quickly it'll be possible to grow tissue, so preserving the body is not that important. You can grow a new body, the thinking goes, but you need your head, you need the brain, which contains the memory, so that you can remember when you come back to life from whence you came. And so among the hardcore cryonicists, preserving just the head is now the preferred option, if you will.
And you know, you really got into reporting about it in the book in depth. So now how do you feel? Are you going to, is Ben Bradley Jr.'s head going to someday be frozen?
Oh, no, not for me. Not for me. Thank you very much. I went out there to the facility in Arizona where Ted and his son is now too, you know, John Henry's
right.
son, who
they signed a pact, right?
Was the one, yeah, who got him into this. And to his credit, John Henry, since he was the one who foisted this upon his father when he died in 2004, suddenly of leukemia, he himself had his remains frozen. So father and son are together out in this facility in Scottsdale, Arizona, called Alcor. And I went there and toured it, and they gave me a tour.
Did you see Ted's head?
Oh, no. They don't show you that, and they're quite discreet. They won't point out which, you know, tank he's in.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Well, do you think, in your research, Ben Bradley Jr., do you think that Ted Williams sincerely believed it, or was he trying to connect with his son late in life?
Well, I think he was definitely trying to connect with his son late in life, and really the last part of the book is about that process, how a father and a son who never really knew each other growing up did connect. And I was curious as to whether Ted really wanted cryonics, and because this was a sad ending for the greatest hitter who ever lived. It was a very ghoulish affair, and I devoted a lot of time and reporting and digging to trying to answer that question. And there's only one Williams child alive. That's the youngest daughter now, Claudia. The oldest daughter, Bobby Jo, who objected to the procedure, she died in 2010. John Henry died in 2004. So Claudia told me, the youngest daughter, told me for the book for the first time the backstory of what she says happened and how this came to pass. And what she told me was that in November of 2000, when Ted was going to have a routine operation, have a pacemaker installed in his chest and his heart, they came to him, Claudia and John Henry, the night before the surgery, and told him that they had decided that they wanted to do cryonics after they died. And they asked him if he would do it with them so that they could be together as a family, quote, forever. And she says Ted agreed. But my reporting suggests that if he did, he was not of sound mind at the time. And in fact, I was able to find about a dozen people whom he told after the date of this meeting in November 2000 that no, he wanted to have his remains cremated and have his ashes thrown off the Florida Keys, where he had lived and fished for many years. And
it is kind of sad, you know, sad to think that when people Google Ted Williams, it's one of the first things that comes up.
Yeah, it's cryonics. The old timers that I interviewed, like his friends and teammates, Johnny Pesky and Dominic DiMaggio and Bobby Doerr, you know, they were all particularly mortified by cryonics and how awful it was, and they worried that it would, as you're suggesting, when you talk about Googling him, they worried that cryonics would affect his legacy, because after all, you were dealing with two or three generations of younger people who didn't have any first-hand knowledge of him as a ball player, but were hearing about him for the first time in the context of this ghastly cryonics business. And but you know, my conclusion was that it has not affected his legacy in the long term. I think people realize that whatever precisely happened here, this was a family deal, and that all families can be dysfunctional. All families have their idiosyncrasies, and I think people are prepared to cut Ted a lot of slack on this issue, and that when you know, the history of Ted Williams is finally written, and with the more passage of time, people's memories of Williams will be of, you know, swaggering youth, the last guy to hit 400, and you know, forever the kid, not this cryonics business.
We're talking with Ben Bradley Jr., and his new book is called The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams. You mentioned earlier that Ted Williams was twice, his career was interrupted by service in the armed forces. That must have been frustrating for him.
Oh, it's terribly frustrating. And, you know, one of the great parlor games that people play when talking about Ted Williams is trying to project what his final statistics would have been had he not missed nearly 5 years of his prime, of his absolute prime, to service in two wars, World War II and Korea. And, you know, he would have been up around 700 home runs, just shy of Babe Ruth's 714, and, of course, well over 3,000 hits. God knows how many runs batted in. And, and it's, you know, he wasn't just doing KP duty in these wars. He was an elite Marine Corps fighter pilot, Top Gun. And he didn't see combat in World War II. They held him back as an instructor. He was that good of a pilot. But in Korea, he was the wingman for John Glenn. And I interviewed Glenn, and Glenn told me that he thought that Williams was one of the greatest pilots he'd ever seen. And it's high praise coming from the astronaut. And, you know, the... And he had a near death experience in Korea, and I was able to track down one of the pilots who flew on this mission with him, and who gave me a first hand account of it and how he guided him back to safety. Williams had gone off on the mission with about 12 other guys, and after he dropped his payload of bombs, he was hit by gunfire. Lost the hydraulics on his plane, lost the radio, the wheels wouldn't come down, and the plane was on fire. I mean, how bad could it get?
It's pretty bad.
And if he'd been following the Marine Corps protocol, he would have ejected. And but he was so tall, nearly 6'4", they had to shoehorn him into the cockpit as it was, and. He decided that if he ejected, he probably would cap his knees and therefore not be able to play ball again. So he resolved just to bring it in, land the plane on its belly, and he skidded for about a mile, and the plane was on flames, and he hopped out without a scratch.
So even with his impending death, he was thinking about getting back behind the plate.
Yeah, I think he was. And... you know, and I think the service in the two wars is particularly extraordinary. When I argue in the book that I think for his legacy, his service in the two wars was more important than playing those 5 years and accumulating the additional numbers, because it gave him a heroic sheen that he otherwise would not have had. And I think the service in the wars is particularly extraordinary when you compare it to the unfathomable prospect that a modern superstar athlete would serve in one war, never mind two.
It's crazy.
Can you see Alex Rodriguez going off to Iraq or Afghanistan?
No.
No, I don't think so.
I can't. So tell us about his 400 season.
Yeah. Well, the 400 season, you know, it came down to the last day, and he went into the last day of the season with an average of 399.5, which would have been rounded up to 400 in the record books. And his manager, Joe Cronin, was urging him to sit out the last game, which, let's face it, a lot of players would have done. But Williams knew that if he did that, there would be an asterisk in the record books. And he said, there's no way. I'm going to play. And it wasn't just one game on his final day. It was a doubleheader.
Wow.
In Philadelphia against the Connie Mack's Philadelphia Athletics. So Williams decided not only to play one of the first game, but to play both games. And he went 6-for-8 on the day. 6-for-8. So that was really his defining moment. That was a courageous decision to risk it all. And he finished well over 400, 406.
Well, he had interesting relationships with women. He was married a few times. He had strained relationships with his mother, with his family. Do you think he was a happy person?
Well, that's a good question. He was an angry person. He struggled with anger. He resented his mother, particularly. I think the anger was rooted in resentment of his mother, who was a Salvation Army worker. in San Diego during the Depression, and what she cared about most in life was trying to save souls on the streets of San Diego. She was a very well-known personality, had the support of the mayor and the city council, was kind of a star of the street, very eccentric woman. And what was most important to her was helping these people who were destitute, down and out. And she'd be out all night, literally, till 10, 11, 12 o'clock at night, working the streets and not home to take care of her son Ted or the younger brother Danny. And the father was an alcoholic and largely absent, so he wasn't a factor. And so Ted and Danny grew up some of the first latchkey kids, really, waiting on the front porch for their mother to come home. So this instilled a great anger and resentment in him. And the anger was a double-edged sword. He used it to his advantage on the baseball field because he said he always hit better mad. So he would manufacture, you know, feuds against the baseball writers or, you know, who he always thought were out to get him. And then, you know, use that as a motivator and go off on a tear and hit 500 for a month or so. But in his personal life, this anger would bubble up at very inappropriate times and places and hurt him immensely with his three wives. He had, you know, three very brief marriages, really, and three children, two daughters and a son, that he struggled to get to know well. And but the flip side of the anger also was, and I think this is a really important point, you know, this is a warts and all treatment that I've done, but it would have been easy just to leave it with the warts, because he said and did a lot of things that were cruel. But my conclusion was that the flip side of that was a fundamental kindness and decency that Williams had, as evidenced chiefly by the work that he did in Boston with the Jimmy Fund, which is a well-known charity here that helps sick kids who had cancer. And back in those days, most of the kids died, but Williams was there visiting them, these kids, at all hours of the day and night, doing what he could to bring good cheer to dying kids. And he raised millions of dollars over the years. And so there was a fundamental kindness and decency to Ted Williams that I think makes his story ultimately a redemptive one.
And you've brought him back to life in this book. It's called The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams. The author, my guest, Ben Bradley Jr. Congratulations on the book, and thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Ben Bradley Jr., his book, The Kid, The Immortal Life of Ted Williams. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time. Thank you.